right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, so you guys, introducing the great Ray McGovern, you know, former CIA, co-founder, veteran, intelligence professionals for sanity, regular contributor at consortiumnews.com and antiwar.com, and keeps his own website, raymcgovern.com. Welcome back, Ray. How are you?
Thanks, Scott. Well, how are you?
I'm doing great. Listen, right around this time every year, I like to interview you and or other people about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. And I know the only thing you like talking about more than that is Russiagate. And even though we just talked about that a couple of weeks ago, there are some new developments. But I thought, first of all, you could tell people about the USS Liberty. Presume they've never heard of it.
Okay. Exactly. Let's see. It was 67. So what is that? 53 years ago on this date, June 8th. There was a spy ship run by NSA and the Navy off Israel, and they were collecting communications what was going on, because the war had begun and was about to end. The Israelis had already destroyed the air forces and most of the armies of Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and the question was what else they intended to do. Now, on the morning around noontime of June 8th, 1967, Israeli planes kind of reconnoitered the USS Liberty, which was 13, I guess, nautical miles off the Israeli coast near Gaza. And then they came back an hour later and shot it up. Now, there's no question about how or whether this was authorized. They knew it was an American ship. It was flying a great big American flag. And more important, we have intercepts where one of the pilots says, "But this American ship, follow your orders." Now, it's very clear that they intended to sink the ship, which would have meant killing almost 300 crew. They had torpedo boats there that shot a big, big hole in the middle of the USS Liberty. And there was a young Texan named Terry Harbardier, who was one of the sailors. And after the Israeli planes had dropped napalm and all kinds of other charges on the deck of the Liberty, Terry says to Captain McGonagall, he says, "Captain, I think I'd like to go and try to connect that one antenna that we couldn't get working. Remember last week we couldn't get it working? The Israelis just shot off all the other antenna. We can't use them. So I request permission to go try to hook up that antenna." And McGonagall says, "Oh, what are you going to do? What are you going to swim across that napalm?" And Halberdier says, "Request permission, sir." Permission granted. He went out with some bailing wire and one end of a big electric circuit, connected the radar that had not been working, and got an SOS out. That SOS is the only reason why 300 crew didn't perish that day. The Israelis intercepted the SOS and immediately broke off the attack. Torpedo boats went back to Ashdod, their base, and the planes went away. Now, meanwhile, and this is the really sad part of the story, the U.S. naval commander of the air forces there in the Mediterranean had scrambled his fighter bombers and were going to the relief of this ship who was under attack. Long story short, the commander got a phone call from Secretary McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense at the time. He said, "No, pull those planes back. Pull those planes back." Now, Admiral Geis was a pretty gutsy guy, and he said, "Sir, one of my ships is under attack. I want to speak to your boss." That would have been Lyndon Johnson. Johnson gets on the phone and he says, "I want you to pull those planes back, pull them back immediately. We don't want this blemish to go on our good friends, our allies." Now, that's not a direct quote. I don't have it in my mind anymore, but that was exactly the essence of it. Everyone was scandalized. 34 U.S. sailors and Marines were killed. 174 were wounded. Even when they tried to put lifeboats over the side, the Israelis shot those lifeboats up. And worse still, when the remainder of them, the survivors, got to port in Malta and then were flown out to Athens, where there were U.S. hospitals, they were told, "Look, you are not to mention this to anyone. You're not to mention it to your wife, your children, under pain of court-martial. You can't even speak to this incident with one another." Whoa. Now, Scott, you want to see PTSD? Talk to one of the survivors of that attack on the U.S. Sicily. I have. I went out for, there was one gutsy congressman. This is worth mentioning. There was a congressman out in the Central Valley of California. His name was Devin Nunes. I didn't know him from Adam. But Terry Harbazier, the young sailor, 23 years old, who saved the Liberty by getting that SOS out, worked for him. Now, Devin Nunes learned about this and said, "Well, have you been appropriately rewarded? And Terry said, "No, sir, I'm just glad to be, just glad to be alive." So Nunes petitioned the Navy having done zero, nothing, nada, nichivo, nothing at all to help the Liberty survivors, because they were under orders not to. So Nunes gets this silver star, I guess it is, that is the second highest award that can be given to a hero like Harbazier. And he says, "I'm going to give this to him out in Visalia, my headquarters in the Central Valley." And I learned about it. I was on the next plane out there because I know these guys really well. And I got there just in time for the next day, about noontime ceremony, where there was a little bit of press there, and Nunes personally gave the award. The press was typically, "Hey, can you show us your flak, the wounds you got from the flak?" He's like, "I'm not gonna show you the flak itself, man." Pull up his shirt, his stomach was, I won't even describe it. Anyhow, I learned by having lunch with those guys after the ceremony what it meant, first, to have this happen. Second, to have to fish out their comrades from where the torpedo struck. And then to be told, "You are not to mention this to anyone under pain of court-martial." Well, they had come out from that PTSD, some of them, and we were able to talk about it then. We've been able to talk about it now. And perhaps best of all, Admiral Maurer, Thomas Maurer, who is actually a pretty big guy, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and ambassador to London. He did a separate investigation and came to the findings, of course, that it was deliberate on the Israelis' part, and that there's no excuse for the timidity on the part of the United States Navy to follow orders for all these years to keep this off the radar screen. I used to go to Arlington Cemetery on this day, where those who survived would gather, usually about 10, 12 of the actual survivors and their wives. And it was a very sad occasion because many are buried in a sort of a collective grave there. Nobody knows about them. It's not even well marked. But we go there every year. We did, at least until, this year we're not observing this. We're observing it, but we're not going anywhere. So it's one of those tragedies. And of course, what's the lesson there? I mean, the lesson is, Well, I mean, let's just speak it out, huh? The Israelis learned 53 years ago that they could get away with murder. They could get away with murdering deliberately. We had those intercepts. I saw them. Deliberately killing USS, U.S. sailors and so forth. And of course, this is something that is not allowed to be said these days. But I'll just say two more things. One is that General Brent Scowcroft, who was the national security advisor to George H.W. Bush and for a while Reagan, when he saw how George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, in subservience to Israel, launched an attack on Iraq that had no justification, in the full expectation that the Iraqis would meet us with cut flowers and welcome us in there, and then what would happen? Well, Chalabi would be in there. He'd recognize Israel. Israel would have nothing to fear from Saddam Hussein anymore. That was not the whole motivation, but it was one third of it. The other third was oil, and the other third was OIL logistics, the business about having permanent military bases in Iraq. So what I'm saying here is that Scowcroft, in the middle of all this, went to the Financial Times, and he said, look, you ought to know that Ariel Sharon, the prime minister of Israel at the time, quote, he has your president wrapped around his little finger, end quote. Now, Scowcroft was a real stable kind of member of the establishment. You know, he would never say anything that he didn't well plan. And this, of course, was well planned. Why did he say that? Well, because he was really, really ticked off that Bush and Cheney would do this on false pretenses, because he knew chapter and verse about the no being, that there being no WMD or that kind of thing. So there you go. You have a very high level person said, look, this has really gone too far. I'm going to blow the whistle on this. He does have the president wrapped around his little finger. Now, the second and last thing I'll say is that I was reflecting on my days in Washington. I left a year ago. I go live in the boondocks now. But while I was there, I made a practice of going not only to lectures where I could ask embarrassing questions, but also, you know, cultural events where every now and then I'd meet my Irish grandmother would call him Muckety Muck, okay, high level guy. So here I am at the Arlington Symphony, and it's intermission, and I'm walking, and my wife says, Ray, that's Senator Warner, Senator John Warner, walking out there, and he was all alone. So I said, aha. So right out the door there, and I said, Senator Warner.
Yes.
He's the senator of the great big white mane, and he was head of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate for about 150 years, and he was the guy that let the Defense Department look into Abu Ghraib all by itself and come up with him. So this is the guy, okay? So I said, he's my senator. I live in Virginia. He's Virginia Senate. Okay, so I said, Senator Warner, you owe me one. He looks at me strangely. I shouldn't say it that way, Senator Warner, but do you remember when you came to Moscow in 1972 to conclude the Incidents at Sea agreement together with SALT and other things? And you came late to the Bolshoi when we had Swan Lake there with Kosygin and Nixon right there. And
oh, I do remember that. I do remember that.
Well, nobody had a seat for you, so I gave you my seat, first row balcony.
Oh, your name again?
McGovern. Oh, yeah, I have something I really want to let you know. Is Israel is trying to get us in a war with Iran. I don't know if you're aware of that, because it's not in the print.
I will say that again.
I said, Israel is trying to get us into a war with Iran. Now, here's the point of my story, okay?
That's a great icebreaker. Remember me from that one time? Let's talk about Israel. All right, go ahead.
So he's got his, you know, he's got his arm on my biceps, you know, and all of a sudden I could not get blood going from into the rest of my body. His hand closed like a vise. It was painful. And as soon as I mentioned the word Israel, and he finally broke it, and he saw somebody he thought he knew. He said, "Oh, John, yeah, come on over here." And then that was it for me. Now, what's my point? My point is here. Warner was about 80 years old at the time. He had achieved all these wonderful things, so to speak, by being part of the system. And he had nothing to be afraid of. And yet the mention of the word Israel prompted him, probably involuntarily, to, what do you say, he's got kind of freeze up. I felt the physical results of that by the fact that blood no longer flowed through my biceps, which he was holding on. So all I'm saying is that it's not possible to relate these stories in polite circles, so to speak. I did get a chance to recount some of them at one of those conferences that the what's that wonderful magazine on the Middle East?
The Washington Report.
Washington Report in the Middle East. You were there, I think, Scott, and you spoke. So here we are. Here we are today. With Israel saying it is annexing the West Bank or portions of it in direct contravention to international law on, I think, it was the 23rd of November, 1967, so a couple of months after the Liberty disaster, there was a UN Security Council resolution which said that Israel return or give up the territories that it seized in the 1967 war. You know, the whole war was a hoax. I mean, we know from Miko Peled's father was one of the generals. Miko has recently written in articles just confirming what others have said, including former Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Begin said in the New York Times, during a speech, he was quoted in the New York Times, let's not pretend that we were threatened by the Egyptian army. We weren't. We chose that time to do what we did, and we were smart people to do that. Now, that's the fact. I mean, he was the prime minister, and Miko and his father confirmed that. So what we've got now is a territory that has been annexed and sort of ruled by Israel, or not quite yet annexed, or not quite yet brought into Israel proper. I've been there. I've been there a couple of times, and I see how those people live. And the notion that they will not be given citizenship, we will have an apartheid state. The only problem is since it's Israel, when we try to apply the same mechanisms like boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, we tried to do that, which we did in South Africa, and that was a miracle. I mean, I don't know anyone that thought that there would be a relatively peaceful transition of power in that country. Nobody, and it happened. So now we try to do that with respect to Israel. And my God, all hell breaks loose. People are prohibited from speaking at universities. People are called anti-Semitic. You know, what's going on there is apartheid, pure and simple. And some of the folks that were really close to Nelson Mandela have been in the West Bank. And you know what they say? They say it's worse. It's worse than apartheid was in South Africa. I mean, that's saying something. And what do? Well, because of this strange hold that the Israeli lobby has on us, manifested physically by Senator Warner and my biceps, we support them in this outrageous apartheid, racism, pure and simple.
All right. Well, so let me ask you, and, you know, you've been around the block a few times, worked at the CIA as a very high level analyst for 27 years, briefing the president and vice president and this kind of thing in the 1980s and all of that. So what is it that they have on Senator Warner? Or what is it that they're holding over the USA? They promise that they don't give a damn. They'd be happy to drop a H-bomb on D.C. if we don't do whatever they say, or they'll prove that our entire Senate is all pedophiles, or what?
Well, I think it's mostly money, kind of the root of all evil. you know, we have a situation in the U.S. Congress where if the Israelis don't like you, they'll throw you out. Cynthia McKinney is one example of that.
Well, no question about that. I mean, we talked a lot about the power of the Israel lobby, but you seem to be hinting that there's something more to it. I mean, I'm reminded of the Edward Snowden documents. This one was only in The Guardian and never was printed in The New York Times, about how the NSA essentially gives their entire hall over to the Israelis every day. So the NSA that's scooping up everything is handing over everything to the Israelis. So in other words, it could be 435 different things for 435 different congressmen that they've got, you know. But they sure know everything about anybody that they're interested in knowing about. No question there.
And I know from very authoritative sources that that began with one person like Pollard in the NSA, sort of doing this all by himself. Now, that is putting a little extra line in so that Israel will get everything we have.
And so instead of locking that guy up, they just legalized it and made that the policy?
Yeah, they regularized it. So, yeah, it's pretty bad. And it, as my Russian teacher used to say, this is nothing to laugh. This is nothing to laugh. Why are you laughing? Who are you laughing? Do not laugh.
That's funny. They don't do articles, the Russians.
If we didn't have two presidents who are former generals, Washington was one, Eisenhower was another, who warned specifically about foreign entanglements, the notion of having a passionate attachment of one country to another, which would leave you with the impression that the goals and the objectives of this one country were the same as yours. Well, Washington saw that. And in his farewell address, he spoke out against it. At the time, it was France. Everybody wanted to come to France's aid because they were in war with Britain. And France helped us a lot. And he doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Eisenhower warned also about these things. So,
well, back to the two-state thing or the annexation problem here that you're talking about, you know, as your example of the hold that the Israel lobby still has and the Israeli government still has over the U.S., that this is a major change, right? For the last 30 years, they have said, just hold your horses. Well, really, the last 40 years, right, since Camp David. They said, just hold your horses. You'll get a Palestinian state. Just give us a little time. We're working on the peace process. You'll get a Palestinian state. Now they're essentially no longer pretending. They're annexing so much of the West Bank, or they claim to be about to, that it will make that an absolute impossibility, even for the most self-deluded American liberal Zionists to be able to hold these conflicting views in their head, and they'll have to choose then. It's a major turning point. What is to happen to the Palestinians? And how is it when there was a future of independence possible for them? That was the trap, you know, the escape hatch, essentially, from being accused of that South African apartheid type system that you're describing. After annexation, there'll just be no question. You're talking about 6 million people, almost something like that, among the Palestinian Christians and Muslims there, in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem and all that. So, but then on this side, the point being back to your point, on this side of the oceans here, it's essentially silence. And I know that there's an epidemic and a protest movement and all these other newsworthy things going on. But this is essentially going unremarked. No controversy whatsoever. And you would think that this would be incredibly controversial because, after all, I think it's super majorities of American Jews support a two-state solution and oppose this kind of annexation. And, you know, certainly it's well within liberal civil rights tradition to think that the Palestinians deserve a little bit more than absolutely nothing. Right. Like if you ask Bernie Sanders, he'd be like, look, we've got to treat these people fairly, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, the two-state solution has been dead for years. The Palestinians have been tricked out of lots of things. Some people consider that their leaders have been naive. Well, there was one who was not so naive. His name was Yasser Arafat, and he was poisoned. He was killed. Huh. Who did it? It was very, 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 very obscure. But I don't know one Palestinian or one objective observer of these kinds of things that doubts that Israeli intelligence did that. Okay. So without leadership and dispersed as they are, and with the Israeli military machine being given millions and millions, billions actually, of arms and money for arms by the United States, the Palestinians hadn't had a chance. Now, what's really interesting to me, at least, is that how much longer will we be able to say, oh, Israel's the only democracy, democracy in the Middle East? Because you know you're gonna end up with more Palestinians than Israelis in what they are expanding to. Lebensraum is what Hitler called it, room for expansion. Huh? So these Palestinians are not going to be able to vote. They're not going to be citizens. How can you pretend to be a democracy if you don't give everybody a vote, you know? And so that's really pretty basic. And it'll be, you know, be years, unfortunately, before this thing works itself out. But the Israelis, unless they do mass genocide, I'm not suggesting that they would. I would not rule it out. Unless they do that, they'll end up with a patently undemocratic country that even the best pundits under Israeli influence, and a lot of them are in this country, will not be able to pretend that Israel is democracy, much less that they merit, what is it, $3.8 billion of arms support every year from the U.S. Treasury, and they're trying to increase that now. So, you know, we have to get this money out of things because
yeah, I mean, they couldn't massacre millions of people, but they could put them in boxcars and ship them all to Gaza or ship them to the Sinai Desert or maybe just try to force march them, you know, Andrew Jackson style into the Jordan River and hope they can swim.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're talking
about... But it does make sense, though. I mean, I'm, you know, on your point that, well, what are you going to do with these people? Clearly, the Israelis want that land and do not want those people. And they have the martial ability, in a literal sense, to do whatever they want with them, right?
Yeah, and what people need to realize is that there are very sturdy Palestinians who have been living in the West Bank forever, okay? They're not going to take this sitting down. Now, some of you will remember Ahed Tamimi, who slapped an Israeli soldier and did 6 months in jail for that and yep. Became kind of a hero. I know her. I met her. I stayed at her father's, Bassem Tamimi's house. That was 3 years ago with a Veterans for Peace delegation. Why do I say that? I say that because I talked to her father after everyone else was in bed, and I said, Bassem, how can you encourage or how can you allow your children to go up there and challenge the wall? Your brother-in-law was shot by a sniper in the head, killed. One of your sons had his leg blown off. He's crippled. How can you? We just did a very dangerous demonstration. We were all tear gassed earlier today. Well, how can you let the kids do this? He looked at me like I was from Mars. He says, Ray, what's the alternative? What's the alternative? Do you want me to tell my children that they have to live under foreign occupiers without protesting? Is that what you're trying to say to me? There's no alternative, Ray. I will not restrain my children. Now, later, of course, Ahmed, she must be about 18 or 19 now. She was arrested for slapping the Israeli soldier, and her mother was put in jail again as well. But they're not going to stop. Moral of the story is that these people have guts that you wouldn't believe. And powerless as they seem, they have the moral authority on their side. And as long as the world is not, when the world gets out of this COVID-19 tragedy and begins to pay attention again, I think there are enough people, I hope there are enough people in enough countries to put the BDS into real effective force and to shame the United States into not doing anything further to establish apartheid in Israel.
Hey man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott. And say $500. Let's talk about Russiagate, the worst president in all of American history, according to you, which I don't think there's any way measures up to Truman or Wilson or a few others. But anyway, according to you, the worst president of the United States, he was framed by the FBI Counterintelligence Division and the CIA for being a traitor under the control of the Kremlin, of all things, which happens to be your specialty. And you never believed it, and you defended him from day one because you're not a partisan except for the truth. And so there have been recent developments even since we last spoke. And you have two new articles at consortiumnews.com. Turn out the lights, Russiagate is over. And a memo to the Attorney General, more on Mueller's forensics, free findings here. So, I'll say one more thing. I'm actually not sure the original source of this. Oh, I know. Yeah, it's what's his name? Greg Jarrett from Fox News says that nearly three dozen subpoenas have been approved for Obama administration officials. So I guess they haven't been delivered yet. That's like a leak that this is coming. So I don't know. So a possibility that the Durham investigation into the origins of this hoax is developing further. I think it's one of your articles you quote Barr implying that some people are going to be indicted and punished for their roles in this thing. But anyway, you go ahead and take it from there and say whatever you want for the next half hour.
Well, I was saying to myself that Trump, Barr, and Durham, you know, it sounds like a law firm, doesn't it? Trump, Barr, and Durham.
Yeah.
That's what's that's
sounds like bad guys, but in this case, you know, they're on the side of right in this one anyway.
I said lawyers. there's not Let me put it this way. It's hard for the normal person to understand the ethos of an intelligence analyst. The more so because CIA is really two units. One is a political one doing covert action, and the other, which is the one that was established by Harry Truman, he established it to have one place he could go to get the truth, okay? He didn't want to have the filter of the Pentagon, which always said that the Soviets were 10 feet tall. He didn't want the State Department to be massaging the truth to show that their policies are working just splendidly. He wanted one place to go, which was answerable only to him, that he would control our careers, and he could say, look, give it to me straight. What's going on here? Okay. Now, that became adulterated over the years, and especially over the last 10 years or so, it's become pretty much impossible for American citizens to believe that there could be an ethos like ours that says, hey, we're after the truth here, and wherever the chips may fall, that's not our job. We do the truth, okay? So it was not a matter of defending Trump or anything like that, and you weren't suggesting that, I know. It was a matter of smelling a rat as soon as people started saying, Russia did it, Russia did it, Russia did it. Russia did what? Russia hacked into the DNC and gave those terribly damaging emails, all of them authentic, to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks published them 3 days before the Democratic National Committee convention, and it hurt Hillary. Well, number one, it didn't get much play at the time because they had already started to say, Russia did it, Russia did it, Russia did it. And when they were released, when they were published on the 22nd of July, 2016, 3 days before the convention, all the headlines were saying, why did Russia do this? Why did Russia do this? Why did Russia do this? Nobody paid any attention to the content of the emails, which clearly showed that the DNC and the Clinton campaign had stolen the nomination from Bernie Sanders, pure and simple, by the way they rigged the primaries, by everything, okay? So it worked from the beginning to give a kind of a diversion. Now, the diversion became an explanation once, beyond all expectations, Hillary lost, okay? Now, what happened then? Well, there are a couple of things that happened then that are really important. People like James Comey, head of the FBI, John Brennan, head of the CIA, James Clapper, a Russophobe from way back, head of the National Intelligence Setup, they did everything they could before the election to make sure that Hillary won and that Trump lost. It's very simple. It's in the record. Just look at the text exchanges between Peter Strzok of the FBI and his paramour, Lisa Page, who, I will note, is now a big judicial commentator on MSNBC. My God. Anyhow. All right. You look at those text exchanges. It's very, very clear they tried to sabotage Trump and help Hillary. Now, it didn't work. But whoop, wait a second. When it didn't work, they realized, my God, we were so confident that Hillary is going to win that we didn't hide our tracks. Oh, my God. Oh, what's going to happen? Oh, no, this guy Flynn's coming in. And that's just crazy. Oh, he knows where the bodies are buried. Oh, my God, he's got. Oh. So what I'm saying here, Scott, is that a lot of the reasons for Russiagate 2, which I Russiagate 1 was before the election. Okay, Russiagate 2, after the election, were to make sure that they could hide their tracks ex post facto, which, as you and I know, is not really possible in this day and age, and make sure that they didn't get found out. Instead, you lead, your best defense is an offense, and that's what you do. Now, one big question these days is, how much did Obama know? Wow, that's a legitimate question. Why do I say that? Is McGovern against Obama? No, McGovern isn't against anybody. He's not for anybody either. He's for the facts, okay? Now, on the 2nd of September, 2016, Lisa Page, the top lawyer who worked for Deputy FBI Director McCabe, texted her friend, her lover, Peter Strzok, and said, "My God, I'm preparing talking points. POTUS is President of the United States. Okay, POTUS wants to know everything we're doing." End quote. Whoa, POTUS wants to know everything we're doing. The 2nd of September, 2016. That's pretty persuasive evidence that what? That Obama wanted to know everything that we're doing, okay? And then there's also indications from how Obama acted on the 5th of January, just before Trump took office, how he authorized Clapper, Brennan, and Comey to go ahead with this Steele dossier exposure to the president-elect himself, how Comey did the deed by telling him, "Mr. Brennan and Mr. Clapper, you need to leave now because I have something very, very delicate to raise with the president-elect." And so he says to Trump, he says, "Now, Mr. Trump, we have this, it's terribly awkward. We have this dossier, and it shows that, well, we can't prove it. We can't, it's not uncorroborated, but it shows that you were, well, you were messing with prostitutes in Moscow and all manner of other things. Just so you know that, just so you know, because we think the press is gonna have it, and so just so you know." Now, if I were Trump, and Trump was a newbie here in Washington, if I were Trump, I would have said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Comey. I direct you right now to go back to the bureau, clean out your desk. Don't show your face in my presence anymore. You're out of there as soon as I become president on the 20th of January, just a couple of weeks from now. Okay, get out of here. I know that trick. That's JFK. That's J. Edgar Hoover on steroids, for God's sake. It happens to every incoming president, every president-elect. So don't try to pull that stuff on me." Instead, what does Trump do? Yeah, he does the real estate stuff from New York. He says, "I can cajole this guy. I can get him on my side. I can show him how to great." So he plays around with Comey for months and months and finally has to fire him. So that's what's at stake here. Now, Comey, Brennan, and Clapper have all been named not only by the Attorney General Barr, but by the president himself. And the president has said in an interview, let me get this right, yeah, "If things keep going the way they're going, I have a chance to destroy the deep state." Whoa, wow. Now, if things keep going the way they were going, he said that before all these terrible things having to do with the riots about race. That's a big diversion. COVID-19 is another big diversion. Right now, Trump is at a low point. As I see it, he's lost all manner of support, except by his most rabid supporters. He has a choice. And this is the choice that I see. He's got the goods on these guys. As I said, they didn't, you know, they were so sure that Hillary's going to win that James Comey admits that in his book. He says, and I quote, "I was operating in an environment in which Hillary Clinton was sure to be our next president, period," end quote. So if you're operating in that kind of environment, you're going to take all manner of liberties with the law, the Constitution, and regulations. And I mean, you're not going to be indicted, for God's sake. You're going to be promoted or allowed to stay in your job instead of the FBI. So it all makes very good sense that this is how they proceeded. But now the evidence is available to John Durham, who's the U.S. attorney in Connecticut. It's available to a district U.S. attorney named Bash, who's looking into these disclosures about who asked people to be unmasked. And so it's all come to a head. Now, the question is, this is the worst possible time for Trump to claim some credibility. I mean, everybody hates him. Colin Powell is going to vote against him. Everybody and his brother thinks so what's he going to do? Now, you need a psychiatrist to figure this out, but there's a really good one. His name is Justy Frank. He used to do some psychological assessments for us at the CIA. We call them arm's length or distant psychological assessments. And I wrote him last night and I said, Justy, for God's sake, not another book about Bush on the couch or Trump on the couch. What we need now is an assessment. What's Trump going to do? Push has come to shove here. Is he going to let Durham let it all hang out and indict Comey, Brennan, Clapper, and maybe even Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, former? Or is he going to cave? Or what's he going to do? Well, when he's in a desperate frame of mind like this, there's no telling. Some people think he might do a false flag operation, or what do they call it, a wag the dog operation in Venezuela or in Iran. But I think it's much more likely that he'll have to either bite the bullet on this he called these guys vicious people, this deep state. I hate to agree with Trump, but they are. And not only that, but they have lots of chits to call in and lots of people who are involved with them and know what the story is. So bottom line for me is that if he goes ahead and does the gutsy thing, let's say only 49%, then he's going to meet with the kind of resistance that the deep state can mount. And that's going to be formidable, all the more so since they have the complete mainstream media at their beck and call. So there'll be a Donnybrook if he does that. If he doesn't do that, then as a person, and this sounds phony, but I'm going to say it anyway, as a person who has taken only one solemn oath, and that is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that Constitution will not be in the same shape that it was before Trump. Because the deep state, the security state, will have won, will have shown its power, and any incoming president will be treated to the same sort of little, we have this dossier, Mr. President-elect, and we'll have to kowtow to these very, very powerful forces that keep wars going, that give Israel billions of dollars, that do all manner of things to keep the American people as malnourished and as oppressed as most of our people are. So the odds, the stakes are really, really high. And I'm hoping that my friend, Dr. Frank, Justy Frank, will come in and say, you know, he's likely to, my best guess without having him on the couch physically is that he's likely to do this or that. And Justy's been right in the past. We need to draw on all professional resources, in this case, psychiatrists, to figure out how Trump is going to react, because he's in a corner now. He's got something really good going for him. That is the facts on Russiagate. But if he puts that into play, whoa.
Even if Trump says to Barr, you tell Durham, I want to see this thing through the hard way, they might not go along with that, you know? He's not really in control of that, and Durham has already proven his usefulness to the CIA. I wouldn't know why to assume that his job is anything here but to cover for them, just as he did in the torture and murder scandal of the Bush years.
Yeah, that was Obama that, torture and scandal in the Bush years, but it was Obama.
Obama-era cover-up, yeah.
Who did cover up, yeah. Well, we've had this conversation before.
In fact, that's an important point, too. He covered up the Bush-era torture and murder scandal for Barack Obama. So, yeah,
well,
that's right. A bit of nuance with some import there, it seems like. But anyway, go ahead.
You and I agree completely that Durham will do what he's told, okay? Obama told them to let these guys off, even though the evidence was just horrendously accurate and clear. Now, will Barr? Well, Barr is going to do, in my view, what Trump tells him to do. And if Trump tells him, as I fear, look, you know, these are big fish. These are what do you call them? They're really bad people, bad cops. Vicious is the word he used. Well, they are. So if he says to Barr, look, we have a couple of lawyers that falsified evidence. We can get these medium guys at the medium levels, and let's just fold the thing up. Then my guess is that I would be shocked if Barr said, no, we got to get these guys. Now, he'll say, yes, Mr. President, and he'll tell Durham to knock it off. That's what happened last time. I just don't think that, see, Obama was scared, but he was riding pretty high, having just won the election. Trump is scared, but he's riding really, really low. So the question is whether he'll go ahead and do what nobody expects him to do, and that's hold these people accountable. And if he does that, there's going to be a real Donnybrook. And, you know, I started on the Constitution. We care about the Constitution. And when we see liberties being taken with it by the likes of Comey and Clapper and Loretta Lynch, for God's sake, and Brennan, we feel strongly about that. And, you know, last time I checked, our oath has no expiration date on it. Okay. And I don't mean that jocularly. I often think of a good friend of mine. His name was Dave Obie. He was head of the House Budget Committee for many, many years. And he appeared before George Shultz was ordered to appear before Obie on Iran-Contra because, of course, there were all kinds of violations of the law having to do with weapons being delivered to Iran. Okay, so this was late in the Iran-Contra thing, and Shultz made the mistake of saying, you know, Mr. Obie, with all due respect, I'm a little tired, and the American people are tired of all this. Dave Obie says, Mr. Secretary, Shultz was Secretary of State, Mr. Secretary, I didn't take a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, until I got tired. Well, that's the way we look at it, and veteran intelligence professionals will say it's for sanity. We were trained and we were encouraged and we were paid by the American people to tell the truth. And no matter which way the truth cuts, we continue to do that. And have lost.
Well, not
lots.
To tell the truth to us, but to tell the truth to the people in the White House, at least, right?
Yeah, but to tell
don't tell me that they paid you to tell the truth to the American people, Ray.
No. Yeah, we have to
I
tell
mean,
the
Bob
truth.
Bob Perry might have paid you to tell the truth to the American people, but that's different.
Yeah, you know, don't make no mistake. What we're trying to do here is substitute for the stuff you get in the mainstream media, which is a bunch of garbage. And the thing is that Russiagate is already too big to fail, so to speak. So many people are committed to the fable, and people from Lindsey Graham to Jimmy Carter, for God's sake. You know, I mean, so even though one slice of that, namely collusion, has petered out because of what Mueller was able to do, the other thing, which Mueller either did not do, is to say the whole thing. Russian hacking of the DNC was a hoax. And maybe that's the, well, and on this note here, we have, let's see, what's today? The 8th of June. Now, exactly a month ago, on the 7th of May, documents were revealed regarding testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, headed at that time by Conaway, who was substituting for Nunes, and the ranking member was Adam Schiff, whom we all know. Now, Adam Schiff asked the head of CrowdStrike. CrowdStrike was the firm picked and paid for by the Democratic National Committee, just as Christopher Steele was picked and paid for by the Democratic National Committee. They were the ones that Comey let do the forensics on the so-called Russian hack of the DNC. FBI didn't do those forensics? No, they preferred to give it to this firm hired by the DNC itself. Okay. So now, Sean Henry, who is the head of CrowdStrike, testified before that House Intelligence Committee on the 5th of December, 2017. So what are we talking, 2.5 years ago? Okay. What did he say? Well, here's Nunes. Mr. Henry, can you tell us the date that the Russians hacked into the DNC? What would that have been? Henry, Sean Henry, head of CrowdStrike. Has to consult with his lawyer. And he says, well, my counsel advises that we have no evidence that there was exfiltration of the DNC documents. Exfiltration, fancy word for hacked. We sometimes, says Henry, we have very good evidence. We know exactly what happened, but this time we have no concrete evidence.
It's interesting, isn't it, Ray, that his lawyer made him tell the truth about that? I wonder why. Because they could have just kept lying about it and saying, well, I can't show you because we don't have it anymore, but trust us or something, right? But
well, it has something to do with being under oath.
I guess so, yeah.
So that's the... So you mentioned all these subpoenas going out. Well, Lindsey Graham is still trying to persuade most of his committee to let him do what, what's his name, the senator from Illinois has already done. That is, issued dozens of subpoenas. So it's all going to be done over the coming weeks. But in my view, people really are tired of this now. Nobody's going to pay attention anymore, especially with the virus going around and the disturbances having to do with the killing of blacks. So I don't know how that's going to fall out, but they do have the chairs of these committees. And now Johnson is his name, the Senator Johnson from Illinois. He's got a Homeland Security perch, okay? So he can do this, and Lindsey Graham will do the same. But Graham got Rosenstein, who was the acting attorney general for a while, he got him to admit that he never would have approved those last FISA applications if he knew now, if he knew then what he knows now. And then McCabe said, no, he's lying. So it's going to be who said, he said, she said, or he said, and then Lisa Page will come in with MSNBC and say, well, no, I said, he said. So it's going to be a little tedious, I think. The question is, Durham was supposed to report around now, like April, May is what Barr originally said. Now it's June. What's going to happen? Is he just going to kind of go longer and then let it be seen as a pure political ploy employed by Trump to win the election? That's the danger I see. There's enough evidence out there to close the damn thing and to make sure that those who are clearly indictable are indicted. Barr threatens to do that. Trump threatens to do that too. Whether they have the guts to do it is another question. And then whether they have the ability to do it is yet another question. And again, I come down on the side of the Constitution. If these people violated the Constitution, which is very clear to me that they did, they need to be held accountable. Otherwise, every incoming president will be faced with the same kind of situation.
Yeah, hey, listen, I mean, Dave Smith said this. I thought it was great that the seriousness of this scandal, of the fake Russia hoax and the false accusations by these cops and spies against first a major party candidate for president, then the president-elect, then the president himself after being sworn in, that it is as big as the claims were if it had all been true. Essentially, their accusations of his treason were treason. They were acting, they're so far out of their legitimate authority to have done what they did that it's essentially equal to the scandal if the whole story had been true.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't use treason. I would use sedition. It's a little bit more precise in what they did. Since I'm against the death penalty, although I might make an exception in these cases, treason carries the death penalty. Sedition doesn't.
I'm for banishment and exile. I think that is more fitting. You seize all their family's property and you kick all of the Brennans out of America permanently, you know, down to the second cousins.
I think Belmarsh sounds a little better. Maximum security prison in London. Julian should be let out. These guys should be put in.
That sounds fair. You know what? They still have a prison down at Guantanamo Bay. I think John Brennan might know a little something about that. His CIA murdered three men down there.
Yep, and we know that. But, you know, Obama, I have to say that from the very start, I saw that Obama had a very strange relationship with John Brennan. And it began actually as he started to be a candidate. He was still a senator, okay? And he was a progressive senator, or so we thought. And he made a big deal about this illegal eavesdropping, which was going on, note this, even before 9/11, but then went on steroids. Okay, these are the telephone calls and all this kind of stuff, all right? So Obama comes out and says, I am against holding these mega corporations, these big telephone and internet corporations, harmless. They violated the law, they're gonna pay the price. I'm voting for this this bill that says they're going to be held accountable. Oh, that was May 2008, I guess, right? When was he elected? 2008. Yeah. Okay. So what happens? John Brennan joins his team, and in late June, Obama says, "I changed my mind on holding those mega corporations, telecoms accountable. Now I think they should be held harmless." I said to myself, what kind of guy is this? And I wrote about it at the time. I said, look, you know, I'm an intelligence officer. I see a real rat here. Let's be on guard. This guy does not deserve our support if he's going to be this malleable in the hands of, I didn't know whom at the time, but it was at precisely that time Brennan joined his campaign. Then, you know, another telling thing was when the Senate Intelligence Committee, to its great credit, completed a four-year study on CIA torture. What did Obama do? Well, he looked away when John Brennan had his goons go into the Senate computers. Talk about separation of powers, huh? They went into the Senate computers, okay? And then when it became clear that the Senate investigators persisted and that, wonder of wonders, Dianne Feinstein was really supporting her staff, what did he do? He sent his chief of staff to every one of those meetings that they had to declassify or to get this out of the report. His chief of staff, every one of those meetings. And then at the very end, he pleaded with Feinstein. He got John Kerry to weigh in with all those senators. No, don't do this. It'd be a terrible thing. And Feinstein persisted. And I think the way she got it done was she said, Leon, this fellow out there in Colorado, that senator, Mark, what's his name? Can't think of it in a sec, but he lost his bid for reelection. And he feels real strongly about this. And he's going to read the report from the Senate floor. If you don't publish it, it's all redacted. Just publish it. And Obama said, oh, darn. Sorry, John. We have to report it. So what am I saying? I said, what in the world would compel Obama to defend Brennan from these horrendous, horrendous practices. You know, it was very clear. People need to read that executive summary. It was awful what happened. Why was Obama so fastidious, so compelled to defend Brennan on that? I'll say one other thing. There's a fellow named Spencer Ackerman. He's a journalist. He used to be better than he is now, but he was really, really good in telling the story of how this one investigator and his co-workers there working for Dianne Feinstein caused this thing to reach completion. Most things like it do not. And he wrote a three-part series for The Guardian. You should look it up. Ackerman, Ackerman, Spencer, first name. A really good trio of articles showing how Obama was so obsequious to Brennan. And so why is that? I don't know, but it's there. And now we have to ask the question, you know, when Trump said Obamagate, I said, oh, no. Why? Because Trump said it. There is an Obamagate, and it's automatically dismissed because it came out of the mouth of Trump. So, you know, I mentioned before Lisa Page saying the president wants to know everything we're doing. Well, I mean, that's a little bit more than just circumstantial evidence, in my view. And that's one reason why Obama is out on the hustings now, talking about, oh, God, yesterday he talked about the equivalent of Trump. Oh, yeah, the bromance between Trump and Putin. Talked about
Obama said that?
Jesus, yeah, Christ.
Obama. Can you believe that?
My yeah, God. The bromance, and what was the other thing you said? It was equally bad. So you know, Obama,
you know what? Back to what you're saying about the Durham investigation here. Why are they taunting him? You know what I mean? Like, if anything is going to solidify Trump's determination to see the very worst done here in the best sense, I mean, it would be something like Obama waving a red flag at him. You know what I mean? This is completely crazy.
Yeah, I'm saying that Obama has a dog in this fight, okay? And he's just like the others, mounting an offensive here at a time when Trump is at a new low, deservedly so.
Still bad strategy, man. He should wait till he knows if his people are going to be indicted or not before he starts defending himself too much like that, you know?
Yeah, so it's going to be... it's going to be interesting, and you know, I've been talking about a constitutional conflict for years now, but now there will be one or there won't be one. If there is one, it's going to be really, really important how it comes out. If there isn't any, well, that's worse, because that will mean that every president that comes in will be treated to something like Chuck Schumer's warning. Remember, on the 3rd of January, 2016, Chuck says to Rachel Maddow, Rachel, I got an interesting thing to tell you. So they go on the show, and she says, now, Chuck, you said you had something interesting about President-elect Trump. And Schumer says, yes, Rachel. I used to think he was a very smart businessman. He would pick his quarrels, but he's done something very, very stupid, Rachel. Oh, what would that be, Chuck? He's taken on the intelligence community, and they have six ways from Sunday to get you. That was very, very foolish. Oh, thanks, Chuck. Now, 3rd of January, 2017, what happened the day after? Well, on the 5th is when Obama was briefed by the three musketeers, Brennan, Clapper, and Comey, about this dossier that they had on Trump, and should we give him the dossier together with this assessment, this so-called intelligence community assessment, which pretty much, well, which concludes that Putin helped the president-elect become the president-elect, And should we give him the dossier? Yeah, go ahead, give him the dossier. And that's when that little scenario that I spelled out before took place on the 6th, the next day. So you have Schumer on the 3rd, okay, warning pretty clearly what's going to happen if you take on the intelligence community. You have the 5th, Obama says, okay, go get him, okay? On the 6th, they brief Trump as president-elect, not only on this assessment, which says he wouldn't be president if it weren't for the help from Putin, but also we have this dossier. It's very scurrilous. It's not corroborated, but it's out there, just so you know, Mr. President-elect. Mm-hmm. Just so you know.
Yeah, nice little pretext. And then, well, we got to report it now because now that it's he's been confronted with it, we have a hook.
Right.
And then build on that. Just like they did with Mike Flynn, where Clapper told David Ignatius at the Post, take the kill shot. So Ignatius writes something in the Post, and then the FBI says, oh, look, a pretext for us to go interview Flynn about that thing we read in the Post.
Yeah. You know, the challenge is to make this intelligible to the normal citizen. Now, I think your listeners are certainly up to it, but there are certain things that jump out at you and need to be made as simple as possible. And that's what we're struggling with now. Our latest, I'm talking about Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Our latest was a follow-up to a memo we sent to Barr a month after he took office. The date was March 13th, 2019. So a month after he took office. And we tell him at the time, look, Mueller's going to give you this report and it's going to have zero forensics. So this is 9 days before he got the report, okay? We said, so please take a look at it and see if it has zero forensics, it is ipso facto an incomplete report, okay? Give him an incomplete mark and mark the fact that there has zero forensics. We called our memo the forensics-free report by Mueller. And this was before he gave it, okay? And so we rehearsed that just a couple of days ago when we did a follow-up and we said, look, you know, not only will we write about that, but now there's proof. And if you read the New York Times, there's zero proof. It's been a whole month since the head of CrowdStrike testified there was no hack of the DNC. None. Not by Russia, not by anybody. And Mr. Barr, if you're unaware, you need to know first that you have the horse's mouth saying that, the head of CrowdStrike, and you need to know secondly that no one who reads the New York Times or its derivatives knows this. So just so you know, Mr. Barr.
And that is so important, too, that, they knew before they ever started the Mueller investigation that, oh, the Papadopoulos thing, that doesn't really add up. And the Page thing, we know that CIA says he actually works for us and he's all right. And the Mike Flynn and the phone call, he was asking them for a favor. They said no collusion there. And they knew all that before they ever started, before Rosenstein ever turned the thing over to Bob Mueller to even begin this investigation. And then, as you say, 9 months after that, in December of Trump's first year, you have the guy from CrowdStrike admit that, we have no evidence that the Russians got these files. sorry if we might have led anybody to believe otherwise. And then that was it. And then they kept the thing going for another year and a half after that, through the midterm elections in 2018 and until the late spring, early summer of 2019, did they finally admit that they had nothing at all. When they knew they had nothing before they began. They're just dragging the whole thing out just as a smear job. You know, you got to admire it in a way in terms of COINTELPRO ops, you know, taking on the Black Panthers by writing letters in other men's handwriting or whatever. That's one thing. But taking on the president this way, it's quite an accomplishment. I mean, they failed, but it's still, you know, for the level of op that they mounted here, it's pretty substantial.
The big difference, Scott, I would suggest between then and now is that now the entire mainstream media has bought into this fable to the point where American people don't have a chance to know what's going on. Really and truly, these are bright people who are interested in the truth, but they have been so conditioned to believing that the Russians hacked into the DNC that I have some of my old buddies up there in New York that I went to college with. They just can't deal with it.
That's true. I mean, all these new developments, they don't get coverage on CNN. They don't get a thing. There's not a big headline in the New York Times. Oh, it turns out that after all, they knew that they were lying. Oops. Nope. No comeuppance, just like with Iraq. Hell, just like with Syria. No admission that they were ever wrong about any of it. And so just keep rolling on. And as you say, people who aren't exposed to mostly right-wing partisan media, they don't ever even get to hear this stuff. Other than, you know, if you read Greenwald or a couple of other, you know, Matt Taibbi or a couple of Aaron Maté, of course, on the left. But other than that, certainly not on TV. They never frame it this way, that, hey, that whole narrative, it turns out it really wasn't true after all. They never came clean. Even when the Mueller report came out, they were still just trying to cherry pick things to say they were right, mostly, you know?
Yeah, you know, Scott, it's all terribly reminiscent of weapons of mass destruction. And as consequential, I would suggest. Well, not I take that back. There's bedlam in the Middle East now. But, you know, there were a few of us that were right in saying there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, that Colin Powell was lying through his teeth. He, too, emerged yesterday to have his word. And nobody really kind of fessed up. There was one exception, and this is worth recording. The head of the editorial section of the Washington Post, Fred Hyatt, he's been in place 20 years, count them, 20 years, okay? Well, after the debacle on Iraq, where there were no weapons of mass destruction, he was asked at the Columbia Journalism Institute, the one that puts out that report, tell me, Mr. Hyatt, tell me what you kept saying, that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. How do you explain that? This is what Hyatt said. We did assert it as flat fact. And if it were wrong, we probably shouldn't have said it. Now, end quote. Now, Bob Perry commented, he says, you know, that's sort of like a cardinal facet of journalism. If it's wrong, you probably shouldn't say it. You know? God. So that's funny. What I was going to say is there was one after. Remember that fellow May who did all the investigations for a whole year afterwards and given $1 billion to find those weapons of mass destruction? Well, he finally reported, I think it was the spring of probably 2005 or 2004, that there weren't any, and he could verify it. They tracked it all down. Well, I happened to be out in Detroit speaking to the editorial board of the, was it Detroit News, and they used to have a really good paper out there, the major Detroit paper there. I'll remember the name in a second. So, were they welcoming me? The whole board and others came around and said, how do you explain this? There's no weapons of mass destruction. They were physically disheveled. And, you know, they hadn't been reading my stuff, of course. So I laid it all out for them. Do you know what the editor of the editorial page did? He apologized 2 days later. Hmm. He apologized to his readers, and he suggested that other major newspapers do the same, because this was a terrible mistake. And how could they have been so reckless in just repeating this garbage? Now, it was nice that I had that opportunity to take them through that, but there were no other newspapers that did that. Detroit, I can't remember the name of it, but anyhow, what I'm saying is here, nobody paid any price. Fred Hyatt is still head of the editorial section of the Washington Post. Yep. And, you know, except for that one Judy Miller, who has sort of disappeared somewhere. Nobody paid a price. Not David Sanger, not all those other New York Times people who...
Michael Gordon, he's at the Wall Street Journal now.
And they're the same guys that are playing this leading role in Russiagate. So you would think that the Americans might have a chance to look at all this, but trying to make a living, trying to put food on the table, you kick your slippers off and you watch Fox News and you don't really learn an awful lot. Although I guess you can learn as much from Fox News these days as the others, given even though it's slanted one way or the other.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I better cut you off here. We're at an hour 20 and I want people to want to listen to this thing. I love talking to you, Ray. We could do this all afternoon if you were an Austinite.
Well, I enjoyed it, Scott, and keep up the good work, man.
Okay, good deal, man. Talk to you again very soon. Thanks, Ray.
That's great. Bye now.
All right, you guys, the great Ray McGovern, you can find all that he writes over there at consortiumnews.com, and we rerun almost all that at antiwar.com, too.
The Scott Horton Show, Antiwar Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.